Good evening. This is Patrick Donahue. We appreciate you listening this week. Tonight, we're going to try to talk about the miraculous gifts. And we're going to do that from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 8 through 13. We've had a number of calls in the last several weeks regarding the miraculous gifts. We're talking about tongues and prophecy. And 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10 is a key passage on this. Let me read that for us. 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10. Reads, charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. So it's clear from this passage that the miraculous gifts were to cease at some point in time. The only debate is when. It says charity never faileth, but prophecy, they will fail. Tongues, they shall cease. Knowledge, it shall vanish away. And it says, this is going to happen when that which is perfect is come. So the Bible is saying here that tongues and prophecy, and here we're talking about the word of knowledge, a miraculous gift, these things are going to stop when that which is perfect is come. No doubt about that. The only question is when is it going to occur? What is that which is perfect? Now, the text does not specifically spell out for us what that which is perfect is. So we're going to have to determine from the context what that which is perfect is. Let me illustrate how we're going to use the context to determine what that which is perfect is. For example, a part of an apple would come from a whole or complete apple, not a whole orange, right? Or a full gas tank is the completion of a partially filled gas tank. See what I mean? So we see that a part of something is always of the same essence as the whole of that thing. Meaning, a part of something, the part is going to be the same thing as the whole, but just a different amount, is what I'm saying. Likewise, the perfect or complete that we read about in 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10, is going to be of the same essence or nature as the part already identified by the context. And thankfully, the part is identified for us in this context. Verse 9 says, we know in part and we prophesy in part. Prophecy and miraculously obtained knowledge were both means by which God revealed His New Testament law in parts in the first century. Notice verse 9 again. We know in part and we prophesy in part. Back before the New Testament was completed, how were the early Christians supposed to know God's New Testament law, how they're supposed to live? Well, He would use men of God, apostles and prophets, to prophesy or to speak in tongues or give them miraculously obtained knowledge, and He would reveal to them parts of the New Testament law that they needed to hear before the whole thing came out. You see what I'm saying? So the prophecy and the miraculous knowledge here in this context were the means by which God revealed His New Testament law in parts in the first century. So the perfect of this context would naturally be the means by which God revealed His New Testament law in whole. That is, in its entirety. That would be the New Testament, completely revealed and all written down for us. The Bible's completion is what I'm saying. You see, when the parts, we know in part and we prophesy in part, those things would stop when that which is perfect is come. The perfect is used in contrast to the part here. The perfect is going to be of the same essence of the part. Just like a part of an apple would be from a whole apple. A part of an orange would be from a whole orange. A piece of an apple pie would be from a whole apple pie. So when we have the part here in 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10, is the means by which God revealed His New Testament law in parts and pieces. Therefore, the perfect would be the means by which God revealed His New Testament law in its completion. In other words, when all of the New Testament was revealed, written down, all of confirmed, put in one place so that it could be read from. Just like we can do today. We can read the New Testament, any part of it we want, all of it and understand all of God's New Testament law. Once the New Testament law, the New Testament was completed in that sense, you wouldn't have any need for the revelation in parts. You wouldn't have any need for somebody to prophesy part of the New Testament law or to speak in tongues part of the New Testament law, because you have the whole thing in front of you, the New Testament canon, which was completed, we'll say, 100 AD, 120 AD, 150 AD. We're not sure of the year, but it was in the first century time frame when the New Testament law was completed, when the New Testament was completed. Once it was completed, that's what's under consideration here in this context, that which is perfect. Once that which is perfect has come, that is the complete New Testament revelation, then the need for prophecy and tongues and the word of knowledge gift were done away. So what we're saying is that prophecy and tongues, the gifts of healing, and the miraculous gifts, I believe there's nine of them listed for us in 1 Corinthians 12, they were in operation in the first century time frame, but they're not in operation today. We don't have prophecy and tongues today, because instead we have the complete New Testament law. It's all that we need. So this passage is teaching that once the New Testament text or canon was completed, once we have the whole New Testament revealed and confirmed, there is no need for further revelation or miraculous confirmation of that revelation. Once the Bible was completed, by God's design, miracles stopped. Like I said, why would you need someone to prophesy New Testament law anymore once all of the New Testament law had already been written down? And therefore, we could just read it from the book. You see what I'm saying? If you have the lines are open. If you have a Bible question or comment on this topic or any other Bible topic, call us at 1-877-655-6755. That number again to call, 1-877-655-6755. If you have a Bible question or a comment about this or any other Bible topic, we'll be glad to take your call. So we're looking at 1 Corinthians 13, 8 through 10 in particular, which says that prophecy will fail, tongues shall cease, the miraculous knowledge, it will vanish away when that which is perfect is come. We've shown from the context that that which is perfect is the complete New Testament revelation, standing in contradistinction to the partial New Testament revelation that we see in verses 8 and 9. And so with the complete revelation, New Testament revelation came, the completed Bible, then we didn't have any need for the prophecy and the tongues anymore to give us the New Testament law in parts. Some counter by claiming that which is perfect in verse 10 refers to the second coming of Christ. But besides ignoring the context, another reason that won't work is because verse 13 of this chapter contrasts the cessation of the gifts with the abiding of faith and hope. Notice verse 13 says, "And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three, but the greatest of these is charity." So the miraculous gifts were to stop sometime before the second coming of Christ. How do I know that? Because verses 8 through 10 say that prophecy and tongues and so forth would stop. In contrast to that, verse 13 is saying that faith and hope will abide. But faith and hope will stop at the second coming of Christ. Once we get to the second coming of Christ, the end of the world, 2 Peter 3, verses 4 and 9 and 10, there won't be any need for faith and hope anymore. But prophecy and tongues stop at that which is perfect. Faith and hope abide through that which is perfect, but they stop at the second coming of Christ. That shows that that which is perfect is describing an event that occurs before the second coming of Christ. We know that because faith and hope, according to verse 13 of 1 Corinthians 13, are said to abide through that which is perfect. But we know from other passages that faith and hope will stop at the second coming of Christ. Let's look at some of those passages. For example, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. Let me read that. And by the way, if you have a Bible question or comment, our lines are open, 1-877-655-6755. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8 reads, "Therefore we are always confident, knowing that whilst we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith not by sight. We are confident, I say, and willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. You see, now we walk by faith, not by sight. Faith is something that you believe in, but you can't see it or touch it. You don't know it by experience. Now, we're not talking about blind faith here. It's based upon evidence. Like, we have faith that George Washington lived. We never saw George Washington. None of us have. We never touched George Washington. We have faith that he existed, but it's based upon good evidence. Eyewitness testimony that he was the first president. That's the way our faith in God is. We've not seen him. We've not touched him, so we don't know he exists in that sense, but we have faith based upon evidence. I mean, how did the moon get there? Well, a man couldn't have put it there. It's got to be from a creator, God. Faith based upon evidence. Back to my original point. Faith is what we have now, but faith will change to sight when Jesus comes back, according to 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. So at Jesus' second coming, faith changes to sight. Once we see Jesus, we won't need to have faith that he exists anymore. We can see this also from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Do you see that we have faith now, but once we see it, once we get to heaven, we won't have to believe it anymore. We won't have to have faith in Jesus anymore. We'll be there with him, talking to him. You see, we'll be able to see him, touch him, we might say. This verse also tells us that hope will stop. The need for hope will stop at the second coming of Christ. It says faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We hope for heaven today. But once we're in heaven, we won't have to hope for it anymore. We'll have it. Like, for example, when we were youngsters, we hoped for a bicycle on one of our birthdays, our parents to give us a bicycle for a birthday present. Once they gave us the bicycle, we didn't have to hope for the bicycle anymore. We had it. It's the same way with hope, our religious hope, the hope of Christianity. Let me show you that from Romans chapter 8, verse 24. The Bible says, therefore, we are saved by hope. But hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for? You see, once we get what we're hoping for, we don't have to hope for it anymore. So, when Jesus comes back at the end of the world, 2 Peter 3, our hope will be realized. We're going to get what we're hoping for. We won't need to hope for it anymore. Do you see then that at the second coming of Christ, there won't be any more faith and hope. Our faith will go to sight. Our hope will be realized. We'll have what we're hoping for. So back to 1 Corinthians 13, the contrast being made between abideth in verse 13 and fail, cease, and vanish away in verse 8 is that the miraculous gifts will stop at that which is perfect, but faith and hope will abide through that which is perfect. That's the point that Paul is making. But we see from these other passages that faith and hope will stop at the second coming of Christ. That proves conclusively that which is perfect cannot be referring to the second coming of Christ. It must be talking about an event that occurs before the second coming of Christ, because faith and hope, according to this passage, are going to abide past that which is perfect. But from other passages, we see that they're going to stop at the second coming of Christ. That leads us back to what the context shows us, and that is that which is perfect refers to the complete New Testament revelation, which occurred in the first century time frame, and that did away with the need for prophecy and tongues. Once we had the means by which God revealed the New Testament law in its entirety, then we didn't need any more the means by which God revealed his New Testament law in pieces and parts. That would be through things like prophecy, tongues, and miraculous knowledge. Appreciate you listening. Patty from California, go ahead with your Bible question or comment, please.
Hi, I'm so glad to talk to you. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious, I've been reading lately about Jesus being the Lion of Judah, and I don't really understand why the New Testament is using that phrase.
Well, first of all, you remember that there were 12 brothers, and their descendants became the 12 tribes of Israel.
Right.
Judah Judah was the brother that Jesus descended from.
Yes.
So he's from Judah. He's from the tribe of Judah.
Yes, sir.
Jesus, I think, is called a lion because of, you know, sometimes he's depicted as being very meek, but he's a lion in the sense he's triumphant. A lion is one of the stronger animals, right? And the lion
right.
is the lion is the king of the jungle, we might say. And Jesus yes. is the king, and he will win the victory over Satan. And if we get
yes,
on his
absolutely.
Team, if we get on his team, we're going to win.
I love that. Triumphant. That would explain it. Yeah. Yes, because I see, you know, there's several passages where God is, you know, depicted as a lion for, you know, for a word picture. So that kind of messes together there. Okay, thank you very much.
Hey, Patty, one thing we can learn from that is some people get confused. We have the love of God and the justice of God. And a lot of people want to emphasize only the love of God. And they come to the wrong conclusion then that everybody's going to be saved even if they don't trust and obey God. But no, Jesus is also a lion. There's going to be judgment upon those that don't serve him faithfully.
He is the judge, and we'll all face that. That's true.
Thank you for your call, Patty.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
I'm going to mention right now, I'm talking to Patty. She's off the air, but I'm mentioning to everybody that if you want to continue Bible study throughout the week, you could do that through a free Bible correspondence course that we offer or just via email with me. You can reach me at BibleCrossfire@email.com. BibleCrossfire@email.com. If you would like a free Bible correspondence course, that way you can do that through the mail in the privacy of your own home at your own pace. Or if you just want to talk to me about different things about the Bible via email, contact me at BibleCrossfire@email.com. Again, the lines are open. If you have a Bible question or comment, call us at 1-877-655-6755. We're back to talking about the miraculous gifts. We've had several calls about this in the last 6 or 8 weeks, and I dealt with it very briefly, so I thought I would dedicate tonight's program to the miraculous gifts. And what we're saying that the Bible teaches is that during the first century time frame, God gave the power to men to prophesy, to speak in tongues, to heal other folks. I mean, at times people were even raised from the dead. Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. Healed people of blindness, things like that. Those things were in operation in the first century time frame. But if you notice 1 Corinthians 13, verses 8 through 10, it says that those things are going to come to an end at some point. Now ask yourself this question. Does it really make any sense for Paul to say the miraculous gifts would stop at the second coming of Christ? Well, everything's going to stop then. That's the end of the world. I'm an Alabama football fan. That would be about like saying Alabama football will stop at the end of the world. Of course. Of course it's going to stop at the end of the world. Everything's going to stop then. Why would Paul say that tongues are going to cease at the second coming of Christ, the end of the world? Everything's going to stop then. The world's going to be burned up. 2 Peter 3, 9 through 10. We're all going to go to either heaven or everlasting punishment. Of course they would not continue on past that. Everything's going to stop then. So when the writer of 1 Corinthians, Paul, says that tongues are going to cease, he's obviously talking about sometime before the end of the world, before the second coming of Christ. Again, we know by the context that he's talking about when he says that which is perfect, he's using the word perfect in the sense of complete. He's talking about the complete New Testament revelation, the complete New Testament law. Because the perfect in verse 10 is contrasted with the part in verse 9. The part in verse 9 is the miraculous knowledge, the gift of the word of knowledge, and prophecy. Now remember, a part of an apple would come from a whole apple, right? Not from a whole orange. So a part of something is going to be of the same essence or nature as that something. So in verse 9, when we see the part, prophecy and miraculous knowledge, that's the means by which God revealed His New Testament law in part. They needed that. They didn't have the New Testament law all written down in one place where they could find out what the truth is just by reading their New Testament. So they needed prophecy and tongues so that God could reveal to them the parts of the New Testament law that they needed that they could not read in the book yet. Once the perfect came, the complete New Testament law, the New Testament in its entirety, once it was all 27 books were revealed and written down and put in one place, then they didn't need the prophecy and the tongues anymore. Why would you need somebody to reveal to you parts of the New Testament law when you can read any part of it you want to, as we can do today? You can read the whole thing in a couple of days if you want to. So once the need for the miraculous, the prophecy and the tongues to reveal parts of God's New Testament law, once that need went away because they had the whole New Testament law, all revealed, put down in the Bible for us, then those miraculous gifts were done away. That's the point of 1 Corinthians 13, 8-10. If you have a Bible question or comment, please call us at 1-877-655-6755. Somebody says, well, why is this so important? Well, it goes back to a verse that we quote on almost every program. John 8, verse 32. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. The truth is that prophecy and tongues and the other miraculous gifts were going to stop. They did stop in the first century time frame. People today, primarily we call them Pentecostals, that claim they can speak in tongues and prophesy and work these miracles, this is all false. I remember when I was growing up watching Ernest Angley on TV, and he would claim to heal people, but it was almost like a joke. It was so funny. He was not healing anybody. They don't heal anybody today. These miraculous gifts did occur during the first century time frame. They had a purpose. That purpose has ceased. That purpose is invalid anymore. We don't need the miraculous gifts anymore now that we have the New Testament law in its entirety. That's the point of this chapter. The miraculous gifts stopped. Tongues stopped. Prophecy stopped. The word of knowledge stopped. These other gifts of healing and things for us, they stopped at that time. And now the Bible is our sole authority in religion. Back then, the Bible was not complete. They had to have the prophecy and tongues to understand New Testament law because the Christians had to have the law, the New Testament law, to live by. Now that we have the Bible in its entirety, the completed New Testament, we don't need that anymore. If a Christian wants to know what to do to be saved or how we're supposed to worship in church, or how we're supposed to live day by day, we don't need a prophet to miraculously tell us. We can just read in the Bible, in the completed New Testament. Every one of us has one or two or maybe even a dozen copies of it. We can read what we're to do as Christians, how we're supposed to live, what a person has to do to be saved, how we're supposed to worship God in church services and so forth. Again, we appreciate you listening. We're going to have to go to a 3-minute break. If you have a Bible question or comment, call us at 1-877-655-6755. If you'll call, I'll try to take you right after the break. If you want to contact me through the week, BibleCrossfire@email.com. If you have a Bible question or comment, call us at 1-877-655-6755. That's 1-877-655-6755. If you have a Bible question or comment about tonight's Bible topic or any other Bible topic, we'll be glad to take your call. What we're talking about tonight is the miraculous gifts like prophecy and tongues. We have a lot of people who claim to be believers today who claim to practice these things, that they still can do these things, but the Bible teaches that these spiritual gifts, these miraculous gifts, stopped in the first century time frame. We notice that in the first segment of this program from 1 Corinthians 13, verses 8 through 10, and also verse 13. We're going to continue on with the discussion of Zechariah 13, showing the same thing back in the Old Testament. Again, the number to call, 1-877-655-6755 if you have a Bible question or comment. I'm going to read to start with from Zechariah chapter 13, verse 2. The Bible says there, "And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, that I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land." Notice, "It shall come to pass in that day, I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land." Now that teaches that true prophets would pass out of the land in that day. But what is that day? What is that day? It's saying that the prophets would pass away in that day. What is that day? Well, first of all, it's not a single 24-hour day, but it's a time period. I mentioned I was an Alabama fan. What if I was to say something like, "In Coach Bryant's day, Alabama won a lot of games"? We wouldn't be talking about one 24-hour day. We'd be talking about a time period, the time period in which Coach Bryant was coaching at the Alabama football team. During that day, his day, during that time period, they won a lot of games. So we're talking in Zechariah 13, we're talking about not a 24-hour day, but a time period. The Bible says that the prophets will pass out of the land in that day, in that time period. So all we got to do is figure out, is that day, that time period, is that talking about, contextually, is that talking about the time period of the first coming of Christ, or the time period of the second coming of Christ? I've been maintaining from 1 Corinthians 13 that the gifts, like prophecy, stopped during the time period of the first coming of Christ. Whereas the Pentecostals will say, no, it's not till the second coming of Christ. But Zechariah 13 is saying that the prophets would pass out of the land in that day. Is that the time period of the first coming of Christ or the second coming of Christ? It can be determined from the context. First of all, notice Zechariah 13, verse 1, the very verse previous to the text we just read. Chapter 13, verse 1 declares, "In that day," that's that same time period, "there shall be a fountain open for sin and for uncleanness." Does the church where you attend sing the song, "There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins"? I think there's two or three songs in the standard hymn books that talk about the fountain. In this case, the fountain filled with blood, a reference to Zechariah 13, verse 1. And what are those songs talking about? They're talking about the death of Christ, the blood of Christ that was spilled for the forgiveness of our sins. So when Zechariah 13, verse 1 declares, "In that day there shall be a fountain open for sin and for uncleanness," to me it's obviously talking about the death of Christ, the first coming of Christ, not the second coming of Christ. I love the figurative expression, a fountain. It's not just a small trickle of blood that can only take care of a few sins. It's a fountain of blood, is the point. It can take Jesus' death, his shedding of his blood, can take care of the sins of every man, every sin of every man for all time. From Adam till the end of time, every man has committed many sins, and Jesus' blood can take care of all of them. Not just a trickle of blood, but a fountain of blood. A figurative expression here, I believe, but I love the way it's used there. Again, Zechariah 13:1 is showing that in that day, the context is the time period of the first coming of Christ, not the second coming of Christ. How about chapter 9, verse 9 of Zechariah? Zechariah 9, verse 9 says, "Thy king cometh unto thee, lowly, and riding upon a donkey, and upon a colt, the foal of a donkey." Now, what does that have to do with? Well, that's quoted in Matthew 21, verse 5, to refer to Jesus' triumphal entry. We call that Jesus' triumphal entry. Matthew 21, verse 5 quotes Zechariah 9, verse 9. Is that then talking about his first coming or his second coming? That's obviously his first coming. If you have a Bible question or comment, call us at 1-877-655-6755. How about Zechariah chapter 11, verses 12 through 13, which prophesies, "So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter." Wonder what that's talking about. Pretty obvious, isn't it? Well, it's quoted in Matthew 27, 9 and 7 to refer to Judas's betrayal of Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Now, did that event occur in connection with the first coming of Christ or the second coming of Christ? Obviously, the first coming. How about Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10, which reads, "His only son whom they have pierced." Well, that's quoted by John 19, verse 37, to refer to Jesus' death. Remember, he's hanging on the cross. They're thinking about breaking his legs to go ahead and so that he'll go die quickly, and they realize he's already dead, so they don't have to break his leg. They pierce his side. Well, that's prophesied by Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. So, is that passage talking about something that has to do with the first coming of Christ or the second coming of Christ? How about Zechariah chapter 13, verse 6, which asks, "What are these wounds in thy hands?" It seems obvious to me that that's talking about the nail scars in Jesus' hands from the nails that were nailed, the nails that were nailed through his hands to hold him up on the cross. First coming of Christ, again. And then how about Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7, which states, "Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered." What's that talking about? Well, that's quoted by Matthew 26, verse 31, to refer to the disciples forsaking Jesus when he was taken to be crucified. Peter is the ultimate example of that. Remember, he denied Jesus three times? That's what Zechariah 13, verse 7 is prophesying. Smite the shepherd Jesus, and the sheep, his disciples like Peter, will be scattered. Do you see, by looking at the context of Zechariah 13, there's a time period being talked about, described, named as "in that day." And we see five or six places in the context that tell us that "in that day" is referring to the time period of the first coming of Christ, not the time period of the second coming of Christ. Now let's go back to Zechariah chapter 13, verse 2. "And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, that I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land." In that day, we've shown by the context, is referring to the time period of the first coming of Christ. And that verse says that the prophets will pass out of the land during that time period, the time period of the first coming of Christ, not the second coming of Christ. So we see this matches up perfectly with 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 shows that prophecy and tongues and miraculous knowledge, the miraculous gifts, were operational during that time. But they stopped when that which is perfect has come, the completed New Testament revelation. That's during the time period of the first coming of Christ, almost 2,000 years ago, not the second coming of Christ, which will happen in future to us. So we're seeing from 1 Corinthians 13 and Zechariah 13 that the miraculous gifts stopped when the New Testament was completed, when all 27 books were revealed and written down and put together in one place so that people could read the New Testament law, instead of having to rely upon the prophets and the tongue speakers to reveal New Testament law in parts. They didn't need that anymore because they had the New Testament law in its entirety when the New Testament was completed. When that happened, the miraculous gifts stopped. You see what I'm saying? Give me a call at 1-877-655-6755. The lines are open. 1-877-655-6755. I've got to believe some of you are members of churches that still try to practice these miraculous gifts. And you may not have been exposed to this teaching before, but it's right there in your Bibles in 1 Corinthians 13. Zechariah chapter 13 shows that these miraculous gifts stopped during the time period of the first coming of Christ, when the New Testament law was completed, when all 27 books were finished. Steve from Wisconsin, go ahead with your Bible question or comment, please.
Hey, Patrick, I got a question relative to Acts 2, where it says in the last days that he will pour out his spirit and men will prophesy. So when you were saying that the gifts of prophecy are over, what is meant in Acts 2:17 when he says in the last days I will pour out my spirit and men will prophesy?
Yeah. And your point, I guess, is what's your point there, Steve?
Well, I'm referring to that you said that the gifts have stopped, and the Bible is saying basically that in the last days these gifts would be evident through pouring out of the Spirit, and men would prophesy, and the men and women, and the dreams, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. How is that relative to where you're coming from on that is the end of the gifts?
Okay. Well, maybe I know what you're getting at, Stephen. Let me respond and see if I'm getting at what you're talking about. Sometimes people are confused by this phrase, the last days, and they think that's future to us. But notice a passage like Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 and 2 says, God, who at sundry times in a diverse manner spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, he's referring to the Old Testament there, he says, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds. And so the writer of the book of Hebrews is saying that in the last days, God spoke through his Son, Jesus Christ. In the Bible, the last days does not refer to things just future to us, but it refers to the time period of the whole New Testament or Christian dispensation. And so when the Bible says that people would prophesy in the last days, they did. That was the beginning part of the last days, the beginning part of the Christian dispensation. People prophesied in that part of the last days, but that wouldn't necessarily mean they're going to prophesy today throughout till the very end of the last days. Do you follow what I'm saying, Steve?
Yeah, I do. It's just that I guess it correlates in Joel 2, where it basically speaks the same thing about pouring out the Spirit and so on and so forth. So like Acts 2 and Joel 2 actually corroborate each other that way.
You're exactly right. Acts 2 is a quote of Joel 2. Joel 2 is prophesying that there would be prophets, actually men and ladies, according to Acts 2:17, that would mm-hmm. prophesy in the last days, and they did. We had male prophets back then, and that back then was the start of the last days, and we had even female prophets. You remember in Acts 20, verse 9, it says that Philip had four virgin daughters that prophesied. And so what Joel prophesied about and what Acts 2 is talking about came true. There were prophets in the last days, and that did occur in the last days. The key here, I think, is to realize from a passage like Hebrews chapter 1, verse 2, that the last days started with the beginning of the Christian dispensation. I think of it as starting in Acts 2, where we have the first gospel sermon. Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve, make sense?
I guess I just was kind of a little befuddled by it, because when you read that, your take on it would be that when you think of the last days, you're thinking the end times, before the end of the world.
Well, but do you see what I'm saying from Hebrews chapter 1, verse 2, that the writer there says, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, so the last days included even the days then. Mm-hmm. I think this term, the last days, is not talking about the end of the world, but it's talking about the days of the Christian dispensation, and they're the last days in contrast to the former days, which was the old times of the Old Testament law in time past, Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. So all of the Christian dispensation, the New Testament dispensation, is called the last days. It's lasted almost 2,000 years now.
Well, I guess I was just questioning that because relative to what you were talking about tonight and trying to put it together on the basis. You bet. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Steve.
you, Beth.
We lost a call a while ago. If you want to call back, call us at 1-877-655-6755. So trying to tie up what we said about Zechariah 13, we see that all of these statements in the context of Zechariah 13 refer to the time period of the first coming of Christ. So Zechariah 13 agrees with 1 Corinthians 13 that prophecy and the other miraculous gifts would stop sometime during the first century time frame and do not still continue on today. Zechariah 13 and 1 Corinthians 13 teach that those miraculous gifts are not in operation today. You know, it only makes sense, as we said before. If the miraculous gifts were to stop at the end of the world, that would go without saying. Why would Paul tell us a specific time these gifts would stop if they were going to stop when everything else stops at the end of the world? Everything's going to stop then. So obviously he wasn't talking about them stopping at the end of the world. Everything's going to stop then. He's talking about some event sometime before the end of the world when prophecy would fail, when tongues would cease, and the word of knowledge would fail. Sometime before the end of the world. Context shows us in 1 Corinthians 13 that he's talking about when the completed New Testament revelation came. When all 27 books of the New Testament were revealed, written down, and all put together, so that now we can read the Bible to find out the truth instead of having to listen to a prophet to find out part of the truth. We've got the whole thing in front of us. The truth is so very important. As we said, John 8:32 says, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free." So we need to understand and believe the truth on the miraculous gifts. And we're going to have to love God, because sometimes people fall more in love with the miraculous gifts that they think they have than they love God. And so when they find out the Bible actually says these things are not for today, they have a hard time giving them up, because they love that idea more than they love God, who said that the gifts would stop, and that the gifts by now have stopped. Rick from Alabama, go ahead with the question or comment, please.
All right, buddy. Listen, I'm in some rolling hills in Kentucky, so I hope I don't lose you.
I know how it is.
My question is this. I listen to a lot of Christian programming, being an over-the-road trucker. I listen to you quite regular. And I listen to another fellow by the name of Hank Kennegraff. Are you familiar with him?
The Bible Answer Man.
Yeah. Now, he goes against everything I've learned over 20-some years of Christianity about the rapture and Jesus coming and taking us to heaven, and while we're up there the 7 years, then the tribulation will be going on down here. He says that's a bunch of bunk. And he really picks on a lot of good preachers like John Hagee and David Jeremiah. And some of them. What is your take on him and that belief of his?
Well, I hadn't heard Hank's view of it, but let me mention a couple of passages about the rapture. First of all, the Greek word, I think it's maybe a Latin word for rapture, but simply means to be caught up.
Right, so I understand. It's not in the Bible, but catching away.
The idea, the word rapture, which means to be caught up, is in the Bible in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 17. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds. That's that word, raptured. Now, if we turn to Matthew 24, up through verse 34 and 35, is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. But after that, is talking about the second coming of Christ. Right. Notice in verse 40 of Matthew 24, it says, "Then shall two be taken in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left." You see, one will be caught up, raptured, and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. So we have the idea of the rapture in Matthew 24, verses 40 through 41, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 17. The faithful Christians who are alive are going to be caught up, and the ones who are not faithful Christians are going to be left. But, now, the premillennialists, and we've had a program dedicated to the end times about a month or 6 weeks ago, the premillennialists make a big mistake. See, they think the faithful Christians will be caught up and gone, and this is where we get the idea for the movie Left Behind, and then the wicked will be here for a number of years living on the earth. But that's not the way it's going to be. When Jesus comes back, faithful Christians will be caught up, they'll be raptured, but 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 9 through 10 says, then the earth is going to be destroyed. You see what I'm saying? Let me read that for you. 2 Peter, this is talking about the second coming of Christ, verse 10, chapter 3, verse 10 says, the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. And we know that's when the faithful Christians will be caught up when Jesus comes back, where they'll be raptured. It says, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, the earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. So when Jesus comes and the faithful Christians are caught up or raptured, and the wicked are left behind, that's just going to be momentarily, because that's going to be the end of the world. There's not going to be any thousand-year reign where the wicked are left behind during the thousand-year reign or anything like that. That's going to be the end of the world. Okay? You see what I'm saying?
The millennial reign idea come from where we're supposed to come back with him from after the 7 years in heaven, married up with the Lamb, and come back rule and reign with him for 1,000 years while Satan's bound in the abyss.
You know, the millennial reign is talked about, is brought up in Revelation chapter 20. But I'm going to tell you something right now. If you study the Bible, you find out that this millennial reign, that's when Jesus is the king and he's reigning. We're in that right now. It's a spiritual reign. Let me read to you, Rick, Acts 2, verses 30 and 31. It says, therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God hath sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his loins, according to his flesh, according to the flesh, he would raise up Christ to sit on his throne, he's seeing this before spake of the resurrection of Christ. So according to this passage, when did Christ begin to sit on his throne? Rick?
Heaven.
It says when...
almost 2,000 years ago.
Yes, it says he would raise up Christ to sit on his throne. He's seeing this before spake of the resurrection of Christ. Yes, the book of Revelation... is figurative language. So the 1,000 years in the book of Revelation 20 is not a literal exactly 1,000 years, but represents a long time. We see passages like Colossians 1:13 and other passages that we're in the kingdom now. It's a spiritual kingdom. Jesus is king, he's reigning now, and we are his subjects if we will serve him as the king. We appreciate you everybody listening tonight. We hope you'll mark our program on your calendars and listen again next week at this same time. In the meantime, if you want to talk to me about the Bible during the week, contact me at BibleCrossfire@email.com. If you want that free Bible correspondence course, also contact me at BibleCrossfire@email.com. Send me your mailing address. Be sure and listen next week at this same time.